The shape of that space has been determined by a variety of considerations, again, some of them aesthetic, some of them administrative, and some of them political. The space that we ultimately had to settle for required forced a reduction in program, and it's meant that we've had to look for other alternatives, both in Manhattan, off-site, and elsewhere, to be able to satisfy several of the objectives, perhaps, or of the destinations, you might say, of an evolving institution. Because I think for the Guggenheim, we have to realize, or at least examine, what the charter of an institution of 20th century art is. You know, do we have an obligation to maintain the Guggenheim collection as it was delivered to us by its founder? Is there a clear charge to expand the collection, and if there is, in what direction? You know, Peter referred to James Johnson Sweeney's accession of the Cezanne. That became a very important event for the institution because it moved us into the field of non-objective art. In other words, the field of figurative art began to open up for the institution, and clearly the addition of Peggy Guggenheim's collection and the Tannhauser collection changed the course of the direction of the institution. It broadened it. It made it an institution fully of 20th century culture. And it suggested that the priority and the mission of the institution as it moved forward was to expand that vision, to expand that understanding of 20th century art to the fullest extent. What happens, I suppose, in the 21st century will be a problem that will be that of my successor. I see my ideas, my vision for the institution to be largely shaped by the conditions that I inherit. The existence of the collections in New York and Venice in their present conditions, the structure of the building programs that were put in place at that time. I see my charge to strengthen the institution, to try to make it the very best that it can be, and indeed to, with a certain amount of hopeful energy applied to the task, I think to make it the best institution of its kind in the world. Now that's sort of a tall order, but I think that that's an order that's in order, if I can use that redundancy of words, because what it means, I think, that to create a vitality for the institution, to not have it lapse simply into a mausoleum to display objects of a set period in time, that we have to be thinking about the future. We have to be thinking about constantly about reinterpretation, re-understanding the objects that are made at a given time, re-evaluating and adding to our overall knowledge of the development of culture. Those are some pretty broad general guidelines for the Guggenheim. What do they mean, finally? What do they mean about the future? What we have to do, finally, is going to be determined by the same kinds of practical considerations that you saw unfold in Peter's story. We are going to have to deal with boards of directors who have specific ideas. We are going to have to deal with artists that have specific ideas, audiences that have specific ideas. We bring professional people to the staff to solicit their ideas and to try to fashion that into a coherent vision. We're going to run up against political roadblocks in terms of what we'd like to do. We're going to have to deal constantly with economic realities. I mean, can we make all this fit together? Can we afford it? And what's the context in which we can afford to continue to develop the institution? You know, very briefly, the Board of Trustees and I have worked for the last 18 months to develop an articulative vision. The staff has contributed to this enormously, and part of, I think, my major message tonight really is to give you a glimpse of what that vision is, what the Christmas is yet to come will look like here at the Guggenheim. Finally, what I'm going to be talking about really is the relationship between the art and the space. And I point out this kind of dynamic is that there is a sort of symbiotic relationship, at least a linked relationship. It's a little bit like a waltz. In other words, you have the collection to begin with. The collection was important. You create a space, the first museum, the second museum space, that's probably a little bit larger than the collection. So you have room to expand it. People have ideas about which way the collection should expand. If you're successful at what you do, you can attract collections, you can bring new people to the cause, you can add new works of art, you can excite artists, you can excite collectors. Your collection grows. It reaches a point where it is right now, where we feel that we cannot show the very best of our permanent collection. The whole rationale for the new edition is that we can show more of the collection that's now kept in storage. The great masterpieces of the 20th century that are in the custody of the Guggenheim can be made available to the public on a more regular basis without sacrificing the interpretive function that special exhibitions bring to the overall enterprise. We also get a sense, however, that with this edition, we're probably approaching our limits. That's a physical reality that we have to address. The difficulty that the Guggenheim has had obtaining permission, the difficulty of building this new building, has certainly taken its toll. And if you look around and you look at the trouble that the Whitney is having, for example, in moving forward with its expansion, one gets a sense that at least for the foreseeable future, the 1990s and beyond, the physical expansion of museum spaces in New York City probably has reached its limits. After the Met's new round of expansion and their completion of their master plan, there probably will be no subsequent development in the foreseeable future in Central Park. What this all runs, however, against, it runs counter to the intuition that we've just seen. I pose the hypothetical question, for example, is that what if the Guggenheim is as successful in the next 50 years at attracting adherence to its cause, attracting collectors, attracting artists perhaps? What if we're successful in building our collections as successful in the next 50 years as we were in the five decades that we've just seen? Where are we going to put that art? How are we going to do it? And if we deny ourselves the opportunity to grow, what will the institution look like? What we've evolved for the Guggenheim, we feel, is a direction that takes advantage of our current assets. You know, I like to say that the Guggenheim, as I look at it, has to operate in the 1990s in a very difficult economic environment. I see that, in general, the operating activities of cultural institutions are going to become more and more difficult to maintain at a break-even level. Revenue streams are leveling off. Audiences are not growing at the rate that they used to. Endowments don't produce the income that they did when they were first created for the institutions, because museums have tended to shade spending on endowment income, and endowments have actually declined relative to the growth of operating budgets. Certainly government support in this country has been declining. Tax laws have made it difficult for cultural institutions to continue to attract gifts, particularly of works of art. At the same side, on the other side of the ledger, we see the expenses rising at an alarming rate. Every time a new record is set at auction, insurance prices ripple up on permanent collection, but particularly on special exhibitions. Makes it more difficult for museums even to contemplate definitive and great exhibitions, because the cost of moving the objects, the cost of insuring them, is becoming prohibitive. There's an upward pressure on salaries. There's an upward pressure that's created by the needs to adapt to new technologies. Finally, we are in the information business, after all. We need computers just like businesses. In fact, we probably need them even more. And there is an enormous latent demand in the opportunities for technology as a function of the imaging capacity of the computers that are just around the corner. Make photography perhaps obsolete. We'll be able to experience works of art, research works of art, understand works of art in ways that we weren't able to do in the past. And this will create, again, a demand, a pressure on the expense side pushing these things up. So as I say, I see a difficult operating environment for institutions. I see, however, also the need to maintain an optimistic future, an open future that allows some room for expansion, room for redefinition, room for change. And it has to be a vision that the staff, that the Board of Trustees, and indeed our audience understands. It has to be a vision that's articulated clearly, and it has to be a vision that's attainable. I'm going to spend the last 5 minutes talking about that vision. I can't, as I said there, I think there's a dynamic between space and objects. I'm going to keep sort of, I'm just going to assume that we're going to have to, there's going to be a dynamic of people. We're going to need talent to make that happen. We're going to need talent in our support groups. We're going to need talent in our boards. We're going to need talent on our staff. But beyond that, there's going to be a dynamic between art and space. I can't really talk about the art because that art is yet to come. The Guggenheim is at a crossroads. We have to assess our spatial needs. We have to assess the scale of our operations in the United States, but we also have to take a look at what kind of profile we want to have abroad. Now, like Peter, I brought a few pictures along. And if I can make this work, can you, somebody back there help me? Yes. We don't need to take a look at that. That's the condition I describe. I used these slides this morning, actually, for a meeting of our business committee, and I wanted to scare them a little bit. So I showed a curve where the costs were far outstripping the revenues. Peter has pointed out that this is our new addition. As you walk out tonight, you can see that we've got steel up through the eighth floor. There should be about 2.5 to 3 more floors erected in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Cladding will go up on the outside of the building, and it will be available for occupancy probably late 1990. The museum will close to the public, unfortunately, in May of this year for about 18 months while the new building is brought online and the existing Frank Lloyd Wright building completely restored. And I'll talk a little bit about the elements of that restoration. I think the point to understand about our current project is that it really has 4 major elements. It is the new addition that Peter referred to, but it also is about the restoration of the Frank Lloyd Wright building and the maximization of its spaces for public access. Now, what does that mean exactly? Well, you see the smaller building to the left of the two Frank Lloyd Wright masses. That's been called in the past the Monitor Building. And traditionally, except for the second floor, which was part of the Tannhauser collection, the Monitor Building has been used for administrative purposes. We will have in our new annex building, tower, whatever we finally decide to call it, 4 floors of exhibition space, and 3 floors of that exhibition space will be double height. So we'll be able to display in a flat, rectilinear space, essentially an effective foil to the curve. We'll be able to display works of art, at least have the potential of displaying works of art of considerable scale. There'll be 2 floors of office space on the top of the building, and 2 floors of office space on the ground floor and the first floor below. That will then be complemented by the office and administrative function that was in the Monitor Building. We'll move to the new building, and the Monitor Building will be open to the public completely. There is a second rotunda in the Monitor Building, smaller, of a different design than the great rotunda that you're all familiar with, but not often a space that's been seen by the public. We open that space up to the public. We will move the restaurant, which is now not functioning because we had to close it during construction. The restaurant will go back to its original space in the space at the far right of this complex on the ground floor at the corner of 88th Street and 5th Avenue. That space has now been occupied by the conservation facility. The conservation lab and a number of our technical services will move to another off-site location. We have purchased an 8-story double-height fireproof building on the west side of Midtown Manhattan. We will have at that location a large part of our technical services, all of our storage. We, by the way, rent storage space in Manhattan and the surrounding area at 8 different locations for our collection and a variety of functions. It's a highly inefficient, it's even a dangerous situation because it's very difficult for us to guarantee the security at those sites. So what you will see is that the large building, the complete restoration of Frank Lloyd Wright inside and out, including new climate control, new security systems, all new glazing will be replacing all the windows with ultraviolet glass that'll filter out any of the dangerous rays. And we will completely restore the exterior facade of the building, which, as I'm sure you've noticed, is in a state of disrepair. We will then develop a facility on the west side of Manhattan, and we will also excavate underground, 1 level down, In fact, the space surrounding this auditorium, we will have improved facilities for this auditorium. Some of our on-site technical services will be located in these spaces. So really, the Guggenheim expansion is a four-pronged expansion in here in New York. The price tag is in excess of $40 million. But we do feel that it will have an effective impact of doubling the exhibition space that we have and the amount of permanent collection that we can display. And it will still give us a great deal of flexibility for doing important world-class exhibitions. Now, I can move through these very quickly. You obviously know the rotunda. I just was making the point about we'd have to replace the skylights over the large rotunda and essentially refurbish the interior. This is a photograph of the model. Unfortunately, the glass slide cracked, so there's that line through it, but you get a sense, and there's a figure in the back for scale. You get a sense of the quality of the space with the kinds of lighting systems that we're going to be having in this space. We'll have galleries like this on three floors of approximately 3,000 square feet per gallery. Essentially, it's a fairly long room, a little over 30 feet in one dimension and about 100 feet in the other dimension. These galleries will join the rotunda on the top ramp, the seventh floor, the fifth floor, the fourth floor, and the second floor. So the access to these galleries will be essentially the access through the elevator shaft that's the museum right now. And there will be an additional elevator shaft at the far northern part of the space. This is a photograph of the smaller rotunda that I talked about. This space will become entirely open to the public. It will be gallery space at all three, at the top three levels, and the museum store will expand by about 400%. Most of the downstairs area that's now occupied by administrative offices, restaurants, and store will be located in the expanded space. Well, the store will inhabit the space that those functions now inhabit. So altogether, we feel that we are going to be strengthening this institution significantly to allow it to do what we feel it does very well, to develop collections of 20th century art, and to continue to preserve and interpret those collections, and indeed the major movements of the 20th century. Now, coming to the Guggenheim, I also had to think a little bit about what to do with Venice. About the only thing that the museum in Venice, the Peggy Guggenheim collection in Venice, shared with the Guggenheim Museum in New York is a director. I inherited that position from Tom Messer. But it's the size of the two institutions, the fact that in terms of operating scale, Peggy is about one-tenth of the size of New York. In terms of space and staff, it's about a similar proportion. And the fact that the Peggy collection has historically been a major part of the permanent presentation in Venice, that's really denied any opportunities for a collaboration. And so there were no particular economies that could accrue from a cooperation between the two institutions. In fact, the programs ran essentially independently of one another, except for an occasional overlap. One of the challenges that we had was how to make Peggy more relevant to New York and vice versa. And immediately that ran up against, or it suggested a conclusion, is that space and this dynamic of art versus space was the issue. Now, in this photograph of the Grand Canal, if I can figure out how to turn this light on. It is on. Is it? Oh, yeah. Oh, I see. Or do I? I have to push. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I can't use that. I don't understand technology. This is Peggy right here. And I got it. Fantastic. There we are. There's our palazzo on the Grand Canal. And you can see Santa Maria della Salute here, the Dogana building, the Monaco, and the San Marco is sort of back off the map. Our first move in Venice was to look at ways of trying to expand the efficiency of the Peggy Guggenheim collection's home on the Grand Canal. And despite the fact that we were not allowed several centuries ago to continue above the ground floor, It doesn't look like we'd be able to get permission from the Italian government to go any further. The superintendent of monuments is not sympathetic to our initial explorations of possibilities of expansion on our current site. If anything, Venice is a little bit more difficult to develop in than in New York City. So we had to look for other alternatives, and one of those alternatives was to look at the space adjacent to the Peggy Palazzo, and we did find a building in back, which is owned by the Fondazione Livi, a foundation dedicated to music, and they were willing to lease it to us for 20 years. So we worked out an agreement with the officials in Venice that the two courtyards can be joined. We will open a passageway in the wall, being very careful not to disturb either the ashes of Peggy or the bones of her dogs, and in effect expand the courtyard of the palazzo. In this space, we will develop a support service area. We will put in a restaurant, we will put in a bookstore, we will put in administrative offices, and we will put in storage facilities. Again, in Venice, we rent storage space at locations other than our current site. That will then allow us to maximize the space of the current palazzo for the display of works of art. It will take the commercial function, the cloakroom, and other activities out of the palazzo, and it will relocate them, we feel, in less central areas. We feel that the courtyard back here, there's a quite wonderful porch in the back that will become essentially a porch for the restaurant. And also this provides an entrance off the fondamenta in the back. So we will actually be able to use this as a major entrance to the collection, or we can still use the present entrance off to the side. But it gives us a little bit more breathing room at our main site in Venice. But our explorations have not stopped there with the Fondazione Livi property. We have, over the past 2 years, been looking extensively at other spaces in cooperation with various groups and official agencies in Venice, both with the Comune and with private foundations. We've explored possible associations with existing foundations like Giorgio Chini. But it seems to be that we're moving toward a solution which is now being commented more and more on in the Italian press, and it's one that I feel we can begin to talk about a little bit here in New York City, in that the space that we have determined that we would most like to occupy in Venice, we feel is potentially the most exciting location in Venice, and that's right at the end of the Grand Canal, this building here, Punta della Dogana, the old customs house. And it's not really used for its original purpose. There has been some speculation from time to time of using this space for the Biennale. We are prepared to take this space if we can negotiate a successful contract with the finance ministry to bring it under the wing of the Guggenheim, to create an exhibition space for special exhibitions that will allow us to do programming both in New York and Venice at the same time. We feel that we can realize certain economies of scale. And we also feel that we will then have the potential to continue to develop the expansion of our collections, which are now somewhat at the saturation point, and even in terms of the available space we have in New York and even with the new building. And we feel that these two institutions, which will, by the way, one Vaporetto stop services both, just have to walk in two different directions. We feel that this addition to the Guggenheim Museum will allow us to realize, as I said, certain efficiencies of operation, because we have a fairly substantial audience at the Palazzo, about 170,000 visitors a year. And when you consider that our exhibition space is only about 3,000 square feet, that the ratio of attendance to area in terms of what we're able to show is very high. We feel that at this location, based on some statistical analysis of the success of Palazzo Grassi on the Grand Canal, that we should probably be able to realize a visitorship that's roughly equal to what we'll be able to have here in New York City. And we feel that would be a very positive benefit for the foundation, and it would certainly help us to discharge our function in the future. So I can talk with a certain amount of guarded optimism, and from time to time, if Tom Messer were here, he would caution me to knock on wood. I'm learning how to do that. Apparently, Guggenheim Museum directors have had that habit from time to time. But I also thought that it might be interesting to share with you, well, actually, let me just sort of comment finally. I think this is the best photograph of all. It shows the proximity of the Punta della Dogana to San Marco. Our palazzo is right there in the corner, the Giudecca, and of course the Grand Canal right here. A sensational space, we feel, and if we're able to realize our ambitions in Venice, we feel will enormously strengthen the Guggenheim's capacity to operate internationally. And a detail of the Dogana building from the air, from the Giudecca side. Now, there is another project that the Guggenheim is actively exploring, and I feel that I can perhaps publicly comment on this for the first time, because there was an article in, I believe, a New York newspaper several weeks ago, which referred to the fact that the Guggenheim Museum was developing a feasibility study for a possible museum in Salzburg in Austria. There's a long and curious story to this project. It began some 2 years ago when Peter and I were approached by a group of citizens from Salzburg when we were in Venice for our advisory board meetings, proposing what we thought then was the preposterous idea of a museum in Salzburg. It seemed to us that Salzburg was, number one, too small, number two, too inexorably linked to Italian Baroque architecture and music to have any room for cultural, visual cultural development. Three, we thought it was too close to Venice, and it didn't seem to fit what we were interested in terms of continuing to develop the institution. After that, I think about a year and a half it took of saying no, and for those of you who are Austrians in the audience, you have a reputation of being a determined and stubborn people, and our no's were never fully accepted. And finally, in May of last year, I went to Salzburg at the invitation of a group of citizens and the chancellor, and it was my intention to emphatically and definitively point out that their proposal was unrealistic, that there was no way that we could ever do it, because first and foremost, where in Salzburg could you put it? For those of you that know Salzburg, touching the if there's any place on earth where touching the architecture may be more difficult than Venice, which is more difficult than New York, it would probably be Salzburg. You can't change a doorknob there without having permission. And we just didn't see it. We didn't see occupying an existing building. We didn't see looking for a larger space at the edge of town. We didn't see a new building. A new building wouldn't somehow fit into the character of the place. It didn't seem to make sense. There was, however, a proposal that had a fairly substantial impact on us. That changed our mind and predisposed us to work with the Austrian government to see if, in fact, it was possible to create a new institution in Austria, in effect a collaboration between the a group of cultural entities in Austria and the Guggenheim here in New York. And the fulcrum for that, or the catalyst for that event, actually was an architectural competition that was conducted by the Burgermeister of Salzburg. And the idea was to develop a hypothetical museum that would be located inside the rock in Salzburg. For those of you that know Salzburg, there is this sort of sweeping, arcing cliff rock that cuts right through the center, really wraps around the center of the town. There's town on this side and there's town on that side. There's really nothing on the top except a gambling casino that some people don't like, a water tower that exists and served part of the need of the city at one time, but now largely doesn't have any useful function. But the notion here was to put a museum, to make a museum with no face, a museum that had no exterior identity, and to put that museum totally inside the rock. Now, on the face of it, the notion of a museum underground doesn't really seem like an exciting one, but this is a museum like no other that I've ever seen. Right here on top of the rock, you really can't see it, but there are a series of skylights. First of all, the designer who won, the architect who won the competition was Hans Holein, an Austrian architect, and it was an international invitational. Seven architects from seven different countries were invited. James Stirling was one of the architects that was invited from England. They were all European. But Holein's design won the competition. And there's a little sort of indentation, a little valley up here. And in that valley, Holein placed a series of skylights that's really pretty much on the ground. You really can't get the sense of how high the trees rise up around this. And actually, in this declension, it's a little bit like a ravine, really, that there are no major trees that would have to be removed to excavate down and place these skylights over the top of the spaces. What the distinctive feature, however, is the fact that there is a central rotunda, which is under this dome right here, that actually goes all the way down to the ground floor. And so that the entrance to the museum would actually be in this courtyard of a building called the Bürgerspital. That courtyard also has an entrance to a parking garage that's buried inside the rock. And again, for those of you that know Salzburg and attend the music festivals there, the Festspiel House is also built partially inside the rock. So there is a tradition of making one's mark inside the rock in Salzburg, which makes the consideration of this museum with no face not such a preposterous idea after all. Anyway, if you look at this rotunda, you will see actually that it is carved out of solid rock to be able to get you down to the ground level. And from the ground floor to the top, it's about 40% taller than the Guggenheim here in New York. So that really is clearly an extraordinary, dramatic space. And this entity of the architecture right here is actually a light shaft, a skylight, really, that brings natural light to a big gallery space that's down on the ground floor. Most of the gallery space, however, is occupied near the top of this gigantic rotunda. And you can see that the facades and walls of this space actually take advantage of the natural cut of the stone. While there are artificial walls here for the display of fairly large-scale works of contemporary art and sculpture can be designed and installed here, essentially this space itself is the work of art, actually, which I kind of like, because what it says in a way is that you give the architect his due. He creates essentially a sensational interior space, and then you make the rest of the spaces, design the rest of the spaces so they'll be suitable for the display of art. And you can see the relationship between this great rotunda and two floors of gallery space that nestle under the skylights on the top. There's a series of fairly conservative rectilinear spaces on both sides of a large open 4,000 square foot atrium space. A second level of gallery spaces underneath these on the right and underneath these on the left, and a ring of gallery spaces around the outside. The project in Salzburg, you can see it from this design. This is one edge of the rock. This is another edge of the rock. This is ground level. There's a tunnel that goes through right here. This is the Festspiel House. This is where the emperors used to wash their horses. This is the entrance to the museum through the Bürgerspital. Those of you that know the great hotel in Salzburg, the Goldener Hirsch, it's right here. The service entrance to this museum is actually from the back side through a tunnel that comes in underneath and allows you to deliver to a storage and elevator shaft underneath in the back. This is where the entrance to the museum would be. Now, it's quite a remarkable piece of architecture. In fact, in Salzburg, it would be completely invisible. The only way to see it really would be that to see the museum from the outside would be via helicopter on the top. This is the shaft of that water tower that I talked about a little earlier. This is the fountain for the horses, and that's the entrance to the Bürgerspital right there. So this would be what you would see to the entrance of the museum. The ground floor of the museum would be hollowed out of space. You can see where the service road comes in, three large storage areas of 4,000 square feet apiece, a 5,000 square foot double height exhibition space. In fact, since this is on the ground floor and the distance between the ground floor and the next floor is some 80 feet, that the height of these spaces could be anything that one wanted. A series of exhibition spaces carved out. Some of these things will have to be redesigned. This is a theater, and this is the entrance from the Bürgerspital. Finally, that's what it would look like at night if you had a helicopter and were flying to the gambling casino. Now, will we realize this? What happened in January was that the Minister Busek created a commission. The commission invited the Guggenheim to undertake a feasibility study. They provided full funding in excess of $500,000 to realize the project. We are doing a major exhibition this summer, which will be at the Biennale on the art around Mondrian, in effect, an exhibition that traces the development from Impressionist to fully abstract art. That will be at Fondazione Giorgio Chini in Venice for the summer. It will then open in Salzburg in August at about the time the feasibility study finishes. If the project is successful, if it's accepted, the various agencies at the level of the Stadt, the city, the state, and the federal government will be responsible for covering all construction costs and providing an operating endowment sufficient to, or a guarantee on the operating costs of the institution sufficient to run the museum at a substantial, substantially at a break-even point. Now, we feel at that point, I mean, I'm sort of talking about now several steps. We opened the museum here in 1991. We have a program in place for the development of in Venice that we would like to see realized by 1992, because that's an important year for Italian-American cooperation. We would like it to mark the 500th anniversary of Italian-American relations, and we think it would be an appropriate way to do that would be with the Guggenheim. And if we're successful, this museum would be scheduled to open in 1995, which just happens to be the millennial birthday of Salzburg. Salzburg is 1,000 years old that year. Whether all this happens remains finally a function of a conjunction of an extraordinary number of forces. Will the necessary support and constituency develop within Europe to fund a museum of this scale and this size? The fact is it's a little bit easier to conceive of that as a government event in Europe than it is in the United States. There's more of a history of cultural support for the arts. Indeed, what it would do for us is that it would allow us to continue to use our collections. It would allow us to continue to develop our collections, we feel, in an absolutely appropriate way that's consistent with the mission of the institution. Will it all happen? I don't know. It remains to be seen. As I said, the forces are complex, but we do feel that we need a vision for the Guggenheim for the future. We feel that this is a coherent, a consistent, a supportable program for the development of the museum in the face of some of the conditions that we're forced to operate in at the moment. We feel it provides a measure of excitement. We feel it's also consistent with forces that are mobilizing throughout the world. The world is becoming increasingly international. We feel that we can deal with some of the rising cost issues by being able to control our own institutions at different locations. And one of the ways of thinking about it is that it's not so different from the Whitney's notion of operating satellite spaces around Manhattan. We've just realized that perhaps the world is a little bit larger than just New York City, although New York City will be our base. In any case, I hope that I've given you a glimpse of the future, created a little bit of excitement for the Guggenheim as it faces the 1990s. I know that there are lots and lots and lots of questions that still have to be answered before we can guarantee that these projects indeed will come to fruition. But there are dedicated people here that work at the museum. We have a visionary board. We have an enthusiastic and growing audience. We feel we have a real shot at doing it. In conclusion, I was coached to say two things. First of all, Wendy informed me that I was to invite you all to a cocktail reception in the Rotunda at 8 o'clock. So consider yourself invited, and I hope to have a word with you all upstairs. And I'd like to conclude by thanking Wendy and the associates. It's been a great pleasure for me to work with Peter. It's becoming a greater pleasure to work with Wendy and to continue the tradition that the Guggenheim family has had at the institution. I think the success of this event is largely due to Wendy's energy and initiative. Wendy, thank you very much.
That's all there is. Drinks upstairs. introduce to you this evening the director of the company, Christopher Keene, who will be interviewed by Bridget Paolucci. Mr. Keene, when he was asked to become director of the New York City Opera, I'm sure, was told that he'd be doing a lot of conducting, but what they didn't tell him was that the conducting would be conducting labor relations. So here they are.
Thank you. Nice. It's good to see you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. We're on. Good. I couldn't be sure. I don't need to tell you, of course, that Christopher Keene is the general director of New York City Opera and has been since March. He's been affiliated with the company since 1969, when he joined the conducting staff as the first recipient of the Julius Rudell Award. He's music director of Art Park and the Long Island Philharmonic, which he founded. He's the former music director of the Syracuse Symphony and the Spoleto Festival, both in Italy and the United States, Christopher, as I remember. He's been active, of course, for many years as a conductor not only of opera but of symphony and with major orchestras and opera companies. And he has conducted numerous premieres of new works. We're going to be talking about that later, and is known, of course, as a leading interpreter of contemporary music. You know, we are supposed to be talking about opera in the 20th century, but I know that everybody's real question tonight is what is going on at City Opera right now?
Well, I hope we'll have some opera in the 20th century. Actually, the strike obviously has been a tragedy for the company, a real devastation. It's been a devastation for the company itself, for all of the performers associated with it, for the opera-going public, and for the city of New York, on whom the impact can be estimated at about $50 million, the cancellation of the season. You know, the multiplying effect of every dollar spent on a ticket in terms of restaurants and parking and babysitting and trains and so forth, income tax, sales taxes, is colossal. And to have one of the principal venues of Lincoln Center closed for this period of 12 weeks has had a tremendous impact, negative impact, upon a city which needs all the help it can get. I'm happy to say, without commenting on the details, that I do believe a settlement's in sight, but it's a complex and tortuous process. There are three unions that have to be negotiated with. The first is the Stagehands Union, the second is the Orchestra Union, and the third is AGMA, the American Guild of Musical Artists, which comprises by far the largest number of people associated with the opera company, the solo singers, the chorus singers, the dancers, and the stage managers. The stagehands were settled fairly early in the negotiation process in April. The orchestra is not settled yet, and it was the orchestra's dispute over the contract proposal which led to the strike and subsequently the cancellation of the season. It now looks like we do have a settlement with the orchestra, although some details are still being worked out. And we still have the complex task of negotiating with AGMA. So without being too optimistic, I can say that we feel optimistic enough to go ahead with our plans for the spring season and our plans for the fall, not for the 1990 season. So it will soon be over, but it's been a long and very difficult process.
Really arduous for you, I think.
Well, arduous for everybody. It is tragic to think of the young people whose careers were depending upon this pivotal exposure. The New York City Opera debut for many young singers is the chance that they have to attract the attention that will make the difference between whether they have a career or not. And you think of parents who had bought tickets and were planning to come to the city to see this tremendous point in their children's lives. And I mean, the small personal tragedies that go with the larger institutional tragedy are really very sad. In addition, I have to be quite frank, the fundraising momentum that's been lost will make the burden of this new administration even more difficult. The City Opera, because of its commitment to a lower ticket price than other opera companies in the country, therefore has to raise more of the money as a terms of percentage than any other opera company in the country. I think we are the second most successful performing arts institution in raising money. On a budget of nearly $30 million, we have to raise $12 million a year. Mm-hmm. Now, the settlements will be more costly than we predicted. That's the inevitable result of the strike, and we've also lost a great deal of time. So that's the negative side. The positive side is we're going forward, and assuming that once this unhappy chapter is closed, we have some very exciting years ahead.
Are you doing things like drawing up contracts that obviously can't be signed yet, but booking singers?
Oh, absolutely.
And all
absolutely.
Of that now?
We actually have the 1990 season completely planned and almost entirely cast, and most of the 1991 season. And it's a tremendous frustration for me that I've been sort of the invisible man since I came in, because obviously, I couldn't announce the next season until I had settlements.
Yes.
And a great deal has been accomplished, and we're all ready to go. So the minute this is settled, within 48 hours or certainly within 2 or 3 days after that, we'll have an announcement of the 1990 season.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
So am I.
I guess we could. I'm sure you are, after all. Are you going to take a vacation?
I won't have time.
You know, when we talked last week, you said there's a widespread perception that opera died with Puccini and Strauss. What makes contemporary opera so very different from mainstream traditional opera?
Well, it's certainly not the subject matter. It has a lot to do with the whole cultural change that has occurred since the First World War, not only in this country, but all over the world. One must remember that in the 19th century, opera filled a very different role in people's lives from what it does today. There was no television, there was no radio, there were no movies, there were no tape recordings, no Sony Walkmans. And opera offered the kind of extravagance of emotional content and visual spectacular that the movies have come to play in the 20th century. So operas have lost the edge at being the most outrageously extravagant form of art that they once had. And people have a great deal more option, a great deal larger range of options today for what to do for entertainment. Opera is no longer the leading contender in that area. Secondly, we have to remember that in the 19th century, people did not go to hear the same masterworks over and over and over again. When Mendelssohn supervised the revival of interests in Bach's music, for example, in Leipzig in the 1830s and 40s, people thought he was crazy. They didn't want to hear Bach, who they thought was some old fogey who'd been forgotten a century before. They wanted to hear brand new Mendelssohn. Nothing could be further from an accurate description of the way the public views new music today. Somewhere around the First World War, and I think the First World War is probably the reason, the disruption and the destruction of values, of a way of life that appeared to be more or less eternal in an uninterrupted continuity for 2,000 years, people turned to music for something quite different. They no longer looked to it for stimulus and for provocation. There'd been enough of that in their lives, and in fact, I think we can say generally that there's enough uncertainty and turbulence in our lives outside of music that we don't need more of it coming from music. And they turned to music increasingly for order and harmony and for a sense that values could endure. This was an entirely different role that the arts have come to play in people's lives in the post-World War I period, and it's one that makes the role of the contemporary composer very difficult, because where he is trying to make a commentary upon what he sees in the contemporary world, most people turn to the arts today for a reassurance that there is a better way and that perhaps things were better in the past. And it makes for a very strange interface between the composer and the public.
That's fascinating. That's, you know, when people talk about the differences, very often they'll talk about the lack of tunefulness or the dissonance or something like that from a purely sound point of view, and you're talking about it from a whole sociological, philosophical point of view.
Well,